Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today we are joined by PGA Tour star Luke Donald. I'd like to thank Luke for his gracious time. He stayed with us for about an hour, and hope you guys enjoy this podcast with the former number one ranked player in the world.
The fried egg requires a different technique. What you need to do is actually square the face so it'll dig down underneath that bad lie and propel that ball right out onto the green.
Here's the thing. Playing out of a buried lie in a bunker is completely different than playing out of a nice, clean lie in a greenside bunker.
You need to be aggressive on any shot, whether it's sitting cleanly or it's a fried egg.
Well, we've all faced it, the dreaded fried egg. It's not to be feared, though. It's actually a pretty easy shot to hit.
Played a lot of golf in Chicago. What are your favorite courses?
Wow, lots of good ones in Chicago. I think it's a little bit of a hidden gem of a place for golf courses. Some of my favorites, Chicago Golf Club, obviously. Very fortunate to have played there. Shore Acres. I practice and play when I'm up there in the summers at Conway Farms. I go to the North Shore Country Club. I love Skokie. It's a great course. I'm trying to think of some other ones. But we were very fortunate when I was at college, you know, to play a rotation of golf courses and, you know, some really good ones. So some of those on that list. Knollwood is another good one. A lot of good ones.
What was the... Northwestern's an interesting school because you're very urban. I mean, you're pretty much essentially an extension of Chicago. What was it like when, you know, coming to America and going to school in Chicago and just like that transition? Was it?
Well, I actually think I was very fortunate to kind of land my feet at Northwestern. I'd never heard of Northwestern growing up in England. I think America's like a very different country to England in terms of, you know, you're just not that aware of all the different colleges. And college golf and college sports is just totally different to what it is in the UK. I'd heard of Harvard and Stanford and Yale and kind of those big kind of places you hear through TV and stuff. But I was recruited by Stanford. Tiger at the time was still on the team, and you know, I thought, well, Tiger's a great player, you know, I've heard of Stanford, this seems like a perfect fit, but ended up not getting there. And the coach there, Wally Goodwin, was a former Northwestern coach, so he said, you know, I feel bad you didn't get in the school. I think you should go visit Northwestern. You know, a good friend of mine, Pat Goss, has just become coach, and I think you'd really like it. So, yeah, I didn't have many options at this point, so I went for a visit. I had some options, but a place I'd never really heard of. But, you know, having got the recommendation, I thought, yeah, let's go have a look. And I just absolutely loved the place. I fell in love with it straight away. You know, all the golf courses, Pat took me around just for my official visit. But I think I was very fortunate that I ended up in a big northern city like that, you know, instead of possibly ending up in a southern place like Clemson or Georgia Tech or Oklahoma State, you know, somewhere that where the culture very different to where I grew up in England. You know, I think Northwestern being right close to Chicago, the big city didn't seem very different to where I grew up just outside of London. So I think in that way, for me, culturally, it wasn't too much of a big of a shock. I didn't really feel homesick. I just got straight into the way of life over at Northwestern straight away. I really enjoyed it.
How was it? And you've spent a lot of, you know, time in Chicago after playing. Like, do you think there's benefit with time away from the game, like with the winter?
I think so. I think even, even just seeing in college, you know, a lot of people say, well, how did you practice? How do you get better? You know, it's the courses are shut 5 months of the year, pretty much up there in Chicago. Like, how were you still able to compete? And we were able to compete. We were a top 20 team in the nation when I was in college. You know, we finished third at NCAAs 1 year, seventh another year. So we were very competitive and strong. And I think actually having that time where you're literally, I mean, we would practice in the indoor, the American football, like indoor AstroTurf area, you know, their practice area. So we could see shots go for about 60 yards, but then they'd hit a net. So again, I think just sometimes having that practice and that time where you're just thinking about fundamentals and you don't care where the ball's going, that has value. You know, I think sometimes, you know, when you're practicing, it's important to do both of those. You know, if you have the ability to practice outside, at times when you're working on things, you shouldn't really worry about what the ball is, how the strike is. You're just trying to feel new movements and correct some fundamentals, and that's what you should be concentrating on. Then you should switch your focus and obviously switch it to, you know, shot making and not thinking about fundamentals. But I think the time we had in Chicago, especially when I was in college, was important because I could really spend some time on some fundamentals that I wanted to work on. And it also forced you to kind of rest a little bit more. You know, I think even in my best years on tour in 2011, 2012, leading up to those years, I would have not touched a club for 6 weeks, 7, 8 weeks possibly, and then had a month to practice. We had more of an off season then, and having that time off was really valuable.
Yeah, you get kind of recharge, you know, mentally.
I mean, what other sport plays all year round? I mean, I can't even think of one other than golf.
It's fascinating too, because what you see with teams that often go deep in the playoffs is they struggle the next year because of all those added games. Like, there's a definite compiling effect.
Unless you're Tom Brady, right? Yeah, I agree with you though. Yes, I think rest recovery is really, really important, and it's hard to do that on the PGA Tour now. I think you're seeing probably more injuries because of it.
Mm-hmm. That's Brady was talking. I heard somebody talking about how Brady's like arm strength. He focuses so much on technique that his arm strength is still, you know, the same at 42 as it was when he was 30, and it's because he's focused so much on the technique of throwing a football, which is.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, he obviously has his methods. Everyone's quite aware of them. You know, he tries to be pliable or something, you know, the TB12 method. But I don't know, whatever he's doing, it's working.
Yeah, it's scary. Think about how many he might end up with. So you, at Northwestern, you were an art and theory major. And you
art theory and practice. Yes.
Art theory and practice. So you also, in your downtime, like to, you know, paint and different art stuff.
I haven't done it for quite a few years now. I think since kids came on the scene, it's kind of taken a back burner. But I certainly, you know, I practiced it. The last time I did anything art-wise really was 2012 for the Ryder Cup, when it was at Medina here in Chicago. Obviously, they were. Remember at one point they did the painted cows and they put them all around the city. So for the Ryder Cup, they decided to do these big painted golf balls, and I did one for the Ryder Cup and auctioned it off, I think. So that was the last time I did any kind of form of art. Now I just kind of watch my daughters scribble and color and paint things. So I don't do too much of that now.
So an age-long debate with golf is like, is it art or is it science? And I know you're also pretty analytical with the game. Where do you kind of fall with the art, well, artistry? And
yeah, it's a good question. I think there has to be a mix of both, really. I mean, you know, sometimes I hear, you know, commentators, or I see someone hit a great shot, and they'll say, "Well, that guy, what great feel he has!" You know, that's. You just can't teach that. And I'm like, I don't agree with that. You know, I don't agree at all with that. You know, I feel like having the understanding of, you know, what makes me a great short game player is I understand the fundamentals very well, and I practice them, and I've got them very, very well. And so I'm able to control my strike, my spin, I'm able to control my trajectory, you know, and through that, I'm able to create great feel. I'm able to hit great shots. And some people might call that, you know, oh, he has great feel, but that's a lot of work over time. So that's a mixture of, you know, that's a lot of science in a way. You know, we hear, you know, Bryson talking about this
procreation or
no I can't remember the word now, but it, you know, it's understanding where everything is in space pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Proception. Yeah.
I know what you're talking about. I can't remember the word,
but
yeah.
But you know that that is worked over through lots of work and practice. For someone who doesn't have the right fundamentals and has, you know, hits it one off the toe, one off the heel, thins one fat one, you know, obviously it's very hard for them to create consistency and get that feel. But once you have those great fundamentals, then you can work on, you know, a little bit more of the art side, the visualizing, the not thinking about the technique so much. You know, I think that's when it becomes more artistic, but you have to build that feel and base of fundamentals before you can kind of do that.
So being one of the, you know, best players around the greens and on the greens for decades, how do you go about building the way you practice?
Yeah, I think first and foremost is, you know, perfecting those fundamentals, you know, really understanding them, what you think is correct fundamentals, and really working hard on them, getting them to a point where you don't have to think about them. Mm-hmm. And once you can do that, then you can come up with great ways to practice, you know, great drills. You know, occasionally I'm hitting balls from the same spot and I'm repeating, you know, doing lots of reps. And that's the time when I'm kind of working on my fundamentals. I'm just trying to groove something in. But that has to be only a small part of your practice, I think, especially with short game. Then you have to start incorporating what golf looks like on the golf course. And that's, you know, every shot is different. So creating variability in your practice, creating a little bit of pressure in your practice, coming up with cool kind of drills to, you know, bring about variability and pressure, I think is really important. And once you put that together with solid fundamentals, then that's only going to pay off and lead to good results.
A lot of Americans have, you know, some, you know, disdain for your exemplary match play record, you know. In terms of match play and stroke play, and you've had great success in both, getting to number one in the world in, you know, in a stroke play heavy schedule, you obviously can play both stroke play and match play. But what would you say, you know, why you have had such success in match play? Is there something about the format that...
Well, I think we... As someone who grew up in England, we kind of grow up around match play, you know, played a lot of it as a junior, as a kid, county golf, you know, playing for my country, England, playing in Walker Cups, you know, playing Eisenhower's, Eisenhower's more stroke play, but, you know, we're very... exposed to it at a pretty early age, so we get used to kind of the feel of match play, because it is quite different. And I think I've always loved the team aspect as well. You know, I think golf is tough sometimes when it comes to just being an individual sport. You and your caddy pretty much most of the time, and you're kind of out there on your own, very much like tennis. You know, it's... And I think once you get into that team atmosphere, that becomes kind of fun. You're playing for something a little bit more than yourself. You know, obviously there's a lot of intricacies to match play. You know, when to give putts, when not to, you know, when to attack, when not to, you know. But ultimately, I still felt like my success in match play came from just being... not forcing issues in a way, you know, making my opponent win holes, you know, not giving away holes, you know, that consistency kind of I had in my game. I'd hit a lot of fairways, I hit a lot of greens, you know, I'd just kind of be there or thereabouts the whole time, and I'd just kind of wear my opponents down through consistency, just not letting them up mentally, almost like thinking, oh, here, I got him on this hole. You know, coupled with some good short game, you know, making putts when you need to, I think is important in match play too. You know, I'm guessing all of those led to, yeah, a pretty decent record in match play.
It's fascinating in match play. I think about like the different player styles where you have guys that, you know, are artists around the greens, or you have your guys that are kind of good at everything. And then you have the power guys that, you know, if you're a middle of the road, shorter hitter, you're looking at the fairway, up the fairway 60 yards at them, and you're hitting your second shot, and everybody puts pressure on each other in different ways and different points of the match, you know, on holes. Was there a specific or type of player that you know, in a single style that you dislike playing against more than another?
I never really thought about it that way. I suppose players that matched up well to me, you know, that were similar to me. You know, I never really was too concerned with players that bombed it past me, although I did lose a couple singles matches to Hank Keeney in the Palmer Cup when I was younger. And that guy would hit it 70 yards past me at that point. I mean, it was just, the matches were close, but, you know, I think when you hit it that far by someone, it does favor in the longer hitter player hands. But I suppose just playing, I remember 2010 Ryder Cup, I was at Celtic Manor, I got paired up against Jim Furyk in the singles, and you know, that I thought was going to be a tricky one, just because we're such similar games. You know, we're always in the hole, we're grinders, we're going to get up and down. You never really think, oh, he's not going to get this one up and down, or he's not going to make this putt. You know, those are the kind of matches that I probably step up and thought that this was going to be a tough match.
Yeah, I think that's one of the fascinating things about match play, is it makes it more like the NBA, where you have like Michael Jordan, you know, a shooting guard, and you know, then you have like your power player, it might be like a Karl Malone. It brings to forefront more of the guy's skills and shows the contrast of how they get it done. It's like, you know, watching somebody I always think about is like Kevin Na has actually a really good record in like the WGC match play, and I think it's because he just plays a little different than everybody. He gets, you know, and the way he gets around the golf course is...
And I think mentally, especially in today's, you know, power game,
yeah,
that we have, you know, over 18 holes, you just feel like, oh, anybody's got a chance, you know, mm-hmm. against anybody. So it's not really like some of the other sports where just the favorites have a chance, you know, in tennis, the top four seeds usually meet in the semifinals, mm-hmm. in golf. You know, over 18 holes, anyone can beat anyone. I mean, and I think mentally for someone like a Kevin Na or someone, that's encouraging.
Yeah. So you've been playing professional golf over the last, you know, two decades now. How do you think the game on tours has changed in that time?
Well, I think it's changed a lot. I think we can look at all kinds of different aspects of the game. Fitness, golf equipment, golf courses. It really has changed a lot. I think we're obviously seeing golfers hit the ball a lot further now than when I started in 2002. You know, it feels like when I started, course management was somewhat important. It's a little bit thrown out the window these days. You know, I think that the aim on most holes is to get it as close as the hole as you can off the tee and go from there. You know, we have people using 64 degree wedges. We have so much loft now and the knowledge as well of how to hit the ball further. That the game has really changed a lot, and it's become a little bit tougher for guys like me, but there's still ways.
Being a shorter hitter, what courses on tour do you feel like, you know, when you tee it up at this course, I've got like great chance this week? And are there courses where you're like, I got to play absolutely perfect to have a chance?
Well, yeah, there are definitely courses that I like to pick and choose. You know, so, I mean, Hilton Head would probably be a great example. Hilton Head actually is a funny one because when I first played there on tour, I didn't play very well there. I don't know, for whatever reason, missed a bunch of cuts, maybe finished top 50 once or twice. And after about 4 or 5 years, I thought, I'm going to not bother going back here for a few years at least. So I gave it a break. And then suddenly I came back and, you know, for a course that should have suited me, I'd done terribly around it. So I came back and then started to perform better because, you know, it's the type of course which takes driver out of a lot of the longer hitters' hands. It's so narrow, a lot of dog legs, you know, very small greens, you know, reasonably flat surfaces, but, you know, tiny greens that, you know, if you're reasonably proficient around the greens, I think you have a good opportunity to get the ball up and down, and you're going to be left with a lot of those tricky 6-7 footers for pars at times. And it's a frustrating course too. You can hit great shots and be blocked out, and you know, think you have a good shot into a green, it catches a tree limb and kicks 30 yards right. So it demands a lot of patience. It doesn't need too much length, and you need to be pretty good around the greens. It's kind of one of those frustrating courses. So, you know, that's a kind of course I tend to be drawn towards. There's less and less of them on tour these days, but yeah, I think I certainly have to be wise with the courses I choose.
What do you think changed from when you took a break and came back and all of a sudden have had unbelievable success? I think you got, was it 4 or 5 runner-ups there?
I've had 5 runners-up and 3 thirds, I believe. Thirds, yeah. So, yeah, 8 top threes without a win, unfortunately. I seem to get picked by someone charging through the field on Sunday a few times. But what has changed? I just think... yeah, I needed that break away from it for a while. You know, for some reason it wasn't working. I couldn't visually see the shots. And for some reason something switched and I was able to you know, manage my way around that course a little bit better. I think my short game in putting did improve, mm-hmm. which helps because it is a course you're not going to hit as many greens as usual. So... you know, I was a good short game player and a good putter through 2006, but I got a lot better from 2009 onwards. You know, after I had a wrist surgery in 2008, I really spent a lot of time practicing from 100 yards in, and that was, you know, that was a lot of the key to me getting to number one in the world. So I think that improved too.
So the injury and the time not being able to, say, go full bore at it, was like had a huge impact on your career the time away.
Yeah, it's funny how sometimes, you know, what you think at the time is going to be one of the biggest negatives turns out to be one of the biggest positives. You know, when obviously you have an injury like that, an injury that had to be surgically repaired, you know, there's all kinds of things that go through your mind. You know, is this the end? Am I going to be able to hit balls again? Am I ever going to be the same? But it kind of allowed me, you know, the way the rehab was, I had to really start with putting for a couple of weeks. Then I could hit some very light chips, but at the same time, I was still putting. You know, I was putting 2-3 hours a day, and then I went and added some small pitches, small chips to, you know, to getting up to wedges. It was a very slow process, but it gave me about a 2-month window where I was really focused on putting especially and short game. And I think it allowed me, like going back to that time, it allowed me some time to really work on fundamentals, to get in the great reps and build up confidence in that area. And yeah, I mean, for 4 or 5 years, I don't think anyone was better than me from 120 yards and in.
Yeah, it's a good spot. That's a good spot to be really good at. You know,
you've got to pick your battles, you know, and I think part of the wrist breakdown was, you know, me trying to keep up with some of the guys, you know, trying to find some extra lengths, try and hit it harder. I've always had a little bit of a wristy swing. I never really used my body to turn. So, you know, when that happened, it was just a good reminder, like, let's just play to what you're good at. You know, you're not going to, it's pointless trying to chase too much distance. You're just going to injure yourself again. So concentrate on what you can control and be good at that.
Yeah, that was a thing that a lot of players went through with you know, kind of the rise of Tiger, the lengthening of the courses. Was, you know, Martin Keimer famously was trying to learn to draw the ball for Augusta, and then, you know, when he went back to hitting the fade, he all of a sudden won a bunch more again. And it's a fascinating thing with you coming back from a back. You know, you're dealing with a back injury now. Is it different because of the back? Is it harder to do like long sessions putting and stuff like that?
Well, yeah, I'm obviously a little bit older than I was when I injured my wrist, which was 2008. But so I've got time is going against me a little bit. But we're fortunate in this game. You know, I can play till I'm 60 really on the Champions Tour if I want to. What's Bernd Lange? He might be 60 now already and still crushing it out there. But you know, I'm trying to see this back injury as, you know, something similar to the wrist injury. You know, it doesn't feel very good at the time, you know, and you're being out and it's frustrating. But hopefully it's a positive. Again, it's given me some time to look at, you know, why did this happen? You know, there's obviously some things going on in my swing that were causing a little bit of this inflammation in my back. And so, you know, I think I'm improving not only my setup, my fundamentals in my golf swing, but hopefully this will lead to some more consistency in my long game. And I mean, I've got to be a little bit careful in terms of reps and smashing balls, but I've been that way for quite a few years now since having kids. I'm more efficient with my practice. I still practice hard, but I practice smart, and I'm not out there, you know, 8 hours a day, every day. You know, I can do a good session in 4 hours and feel like I have done enough work to be one of the best players out there. So it's, again, trying to turn a negative into a positive.
No, that's, I think it gives you, I feel like when you're in the hole and you're looking at the same problem day in, day out, every day, and you're going and, you know, grinding. Like for me, I'm always like, you know, in there thinking about golf and writing and thinking about other stuff. Is like when you take days off, or like even just a day off, is so valuable because you come back with a completely refreshed perspective. But then, you know, I remember I went on our honeymoon and I came back after a 10-day break, and like I was so refreshed and I had a whole new perspective on so many of the same problems I was looking at every day and day out. Like it allows you time away to really think and wash away like the conclusions you have in your head from looking at it through the same lens.
I totally agree. You know, I think that's why weekends are so important for the guy that works, you know, Monday to Friday. You know, they need that refresh feeling so they can tackle the week in front of them. But you know, I've even actually in some of my off time been doing some puzzles now and again. I think it's good for the brain, and you know, 1,000-piece puzzles, and I'll work on them. But if I'm over it for like an hour looking at it, suddenly you just can't see anything. You step away for an hour, come back, and you're like, oh, that was, why didn't I see that piece? That piece goes there. It's amazing how you can become stale by, you know, just being in doing something over and over again without that kind of break.
Yeah, because you're doing the same thing. It's like you're becoming more of a robot instead of a, you know, what makes humans so special is like the ability to, you know, think and adapt, and you know, it's fascinating.
Remember, you only got to get a little bit better every day. So, you know, you're not trying to, you know, take major steps. I think some people, you know, again, if you can just get tiny little bit better every day, then that over time, that's going to lead to something great.
It's, somebody said to me once, when I was a high school golfer, like, you know, there are these great players in the area. It's like, you know, they said to me, it didn't make any sense then, but it was like, well, like the hard thing for him is going to be, how does he get better? You know, now that he's here, because like once you're really great, a really great golfer, then I think this is what the, you know, a lot of, you know, 15 handicaps going from 15 to 10 is tough, but going from, you know, I imagine 70th in the world to 25th is even harder, you know, like trying to pick up those small little percentage points that make the biggest difference.
Yeah, but I think you have to think about it that way. If you start, you know, you got to break things down into little goals that you feel like can be accomplished. You know, if something seems too big, then just break it down into little things. And I think over time, you'll accomplish those little things, and that'll lead to that bigger thing. It's just, yeah, it's all about, you know, we hear the word process and stuff like that. Yeah, I think it's easy to get ahead of ourselves, but if you do it that way, I think it becomes a lot easier.
So with, you know, you have regular events, the week in, week out PGA Tour grind, and then everybody does a little bit different for majors. Like, how would you say your preparation over your career for majors has been different? Does it differ for different venues? Does it differ for different majors? Or is it just the same?
I think at times it differed. You know, I tried lots of different scenarios. Obviously, it was never successful up until this point to get the right scenario. I've been up there quite a few times and had some good chances. But, you know, I think Augusta was always the one that you tried to could prepare a little bit easier. You know, I'd go up there quite a bit before and practice and play. And even though that course wasn't specifically suited towards my game, you know, since some of the changes in 2004 or 2005, that was the course I probably spent the most time playing before the actual tournament. I think one, because it was special and it's very cool, and you never know how many times you're going to have that opportunity to go practice if you're eligible to be in that field. But the other majors, yeah, I tried playing before, the week before. I tried taking weeks off before. I just think sometimes it's going to be your time, and you just find that groove in golf. And sometimes it's not going to work out. But I never found like the kind of the right, what I needed to do to be peaking at that majors, those majors. I came close a few times, but that was tough. Yeah.
What was your favorite major venue that you've played in to date?
I would probably go back to, there's a few of them. Obviously I had a pretty good chance at Marion at the US Open, played with Justin Rose in the final group there when he went on to win. You know, enjoyed that kind of cool, quirky course. I love the Open Championship, obviously being from England. Again, I go back to ones I've had chances, I suppose. Turnberry, mm-hmm. had a good chance the year Stuart Sink won. Absolutely love that golf course. I always love playing at St. Andrews, mm-hmm. you know, just because of the feel, the history. And what St. Andrews is, that was a course I never really enjoyed the first few times I played it. I just didn't quite understand it. I was like, this is like an open field with bumps and humps. And then the more I played it, the more the conditions changed minutely, and it just changed the course completely. And, you know, how important angles were to some of the pins, and, you know, all those kind of cool architectural features that St. Andrews, you know, just kind of had, that was always a special place for me to play.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you hear it with so many people, is like the first time around, they just don't even have a clue what's going on. And then do you have like a light bulb moment of like when you were like, oh, this is it?
Well, it's just certain holes, you know. Even think of, for me especially, like that fourth hole. I wasn't, if the wind was anywhere in my face, I couldn't carry that mound, you know, which was, that's the easy way to go, just go down the left hand side. But you know, if that pin is tucked over on the left hand side, you've got no angle to hit it towards those pins. So you have to take it down that right hand side, that narrow little place. There's a couple bunkers waiting for you. To give yourself the great angle. And, I think it's easy to kind of just blow it to the wide part of the fairway. But, you know, creating that perfect angle to some of those left pins is pretty cool. And you have, that's when you have to step up and hit great shots around St. Andrews.
I know you have some interest in golf course architecture. Is that something that you're looking to get into more as you?
Yeah, I would love to. I've done a little bit of work with Dave Zinkand, who worked a long time with Core and Crenshaw. He was their lead shaper for I think 14 years, and he's doing some work on his own. And we're looking at some projects to do. Down the road, we've even talked to Canal Shores, the little place in Chicago, about maybe doing something there. So that would be fun. I love architecture. I've read some of the books. I love Core and Crenshaw. I love the Doak stuff. Golf course for me is, isn't necessarily about score too, which I think some architects kind of, they're very score related, which, you know, obviously great if you're designing a tour course, I guess. But, you know, what about the other 98% of the golfers that are playing? You know, it's just going to be a tough challenge for them. But, for me, using the land, good aesthetics, good, fun, interesting greens, those kind of things are kind of the types of architecture that I enjoy.
It's fascinating. I think about the Core Crenshaw stuff, and obviously like Trinity Forest was a first time outside of Kapalua where like Core Crenshaw, Doak have really had a course that the world's best have played on, the moderns. Best architects, golf courses. I guess Gil Hanson, Rio was another example. From your perspective, when you go play one of these types of golf courses, is it necessarily easier? Is it easier to score, or does it present different challenges than your standard TPC course?
I haven't played Trinity Forest, but certainly played some good core Crenshaw courses. One of my favorite would be, Friar's Head, Long Island. When I played that, I was just blown away how much fun it was to play. A lot of people, I always get the question, what's your favorite course to play? And a lot of them really aren't tour courses. Tour courses are courses you might play well and shoot 66 round. If you struggle, you're going to shoot 76. It's a little bit more score related. Whereas, courses I love to play, it's quite easy to shoot 62 now and again. I think score isn't really important, though. Mm-hmm. But I could also walk off shooting 72 and not played well and thought, I love this course.
Yeah.
I just had so much fun playing it. Fun green complexes, again, strategy off the tee, making you think, even most of these places now have quite wide fairways, but there's an art to it. You really have to step up on the tee and where's the pin? Where am I going to hit this? Whereas tour courses have a little bit less of that these days.
So I'm curious, if you took par, like the concept of, 72 being par, and you went somewhere like, where you describe where it's, say it was just, if you threw par out the window, how do you think if you played a professional tournament at one of these courses, would it be much different in terms of like, the leaderboard? Like, would you see more varied styles and such?
Well, I think the type of course still has that overriding factor of, you know, who's going to do well, who's not going to do well. But certainly mentally, if you take par out of the equation, I think it just does change it. We talked about this a little bit earlier about how at Pebble Beach that one year they turned the second hole from a par 5 to a par 4, and when it was a par 4, the scoring average was higher. So mentally, I think without any relevance to par, yeah, would that be easier? Probably.
I guess, yeah. And if they just weren't concerned with guys shooting 62s or 58s, or, and they just went to courses that were different, you know, because that's, I guess, from me being, I watch a ton of tour golf, but I also have interest in architecture, is like, I think there's like, there isn't a ton of stylistic difference between a lot of the golf courses on tour. And I think like Harbortown's a perfect example. That is stylistically very different than almost every other course. I think Trinity Force would be another one that's stylistically different, but then, you know, it's sandwiched in, you know, a lot of courses that are very similar. Do you think like if you score to par is, you know, it restrains the options of tournament venues?
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I haven't really thought about this and the best way to answer that, but certainly having variability is nice. Mm-hmm. You know, I think even Riviera would probably be on that list too. It's like it's a course you play and you think this is a little different to most weeks we play. Just has some classic features, some quirkiness, and yeah, it's certainly. People asking me what are my favorite courses on tour, that would be one of them at the top of them.
What's fascinating about Riviera is that I think Charles Howell is the only player, and I have this written down somewhere. I looked it up, but he was the only player younger than 28 to win there in the, like, the last like 16 years. All the winners have been 28 or over, which is to me utterly fascinating. You know.
Yeah, again, it's one of those classic courses that's going to wear on you, I think, with some patience, real understanding of where to miss it, where not to. Again, it brings in a little bit more strategy and thought. There's so many cool features, the bunker in the middle of the green on the sixth, the split fairway on eight, you know, obviously not very long par threes. The 10th hole is obviously talked about as one of the greatest risk reward par fours in the world. So yeah, there's a lot of strategy at that course, and I think when you add a little bit of strategy, guys who've had experience, guys who understand that sometimes backing off is more valuable than just going full tilt, then I think you over four rounds you're going to give them the advantage, and that's probably why older guys, more experienced guys tend to do well at Riviera.
Yeah, because Riviera, that's a course where positioning and being, you know, with the way the greens are and the deep bunkers, being 50 yards away isn't always advantageous versus, you know, being 120 in the right spot, right?
I think so. And a little bit to do with the grass. The Kikuyu is not a grass you can really run up. You know, a 50-yard shot. Those that the Poana greens, you know, have quite a firm first bounce usually, unless it's rained a lot. So that 50-yard shot with like 4 or 5 yard, you know, on the green with not much green to work with, it's impossible to run it through that Kikuyu. So you have to be very precise. So you know, those kind of things, yeah, like, you know, just getting it close to a par 5 and 2 is maybe not always advantageous. Maybe laying back, having that 100-yard shot, the fuller shot, create some spin. Maybe that's a little bit of an easier and a better way to play that place.
With growing up in England, you obviously were exposed to a lot of great golf early at a young age. Like, what were your favorite places over there?
Yeah, I grew up near London, so got to play quite a few of the Heathland courses, you know, Sunningdale, the Berkshire. I've never played the Swinley Forest, but, you know, we obviously played some, also some golf up kind of, you know, the we would play, I've played Hillside, I've played Moortown, I've played... trying to think of some of the other great ones. Obviously, I played a lot in Scotland and Ireland, but I'm trying to think of good ones in England. You know, obviously Lytham, and there's a bunch of those great ones around that Liverpool area that that I got to play. But there's a lot of really good ones in London too.
Yeah. What players growing up did you kind of idolize the most from like a you know, professional standpoint?
Grew up loving Faldo and Seve were my two idols, probably for very different reasons. You know, I think I was in awe of Faldo and his work ethic and how meticulous he was and just the small details he'd went to. You just felt like the guy was on the range, you know, from morning till dusk, you know. Seve, obviously, for his short game, his flair, his ability to get the ball up and down from anywhere. I think that influenced me, certainly. Very different personalities, but those were the two guys that, yeah, for very different reasons, were kind of idols in my eyes.
Yeah, your bunker play could, you know, you could go toe-to-toe with Seve. You know, that would be a fun... Like, I always wonder why golf doesn't have, like, a skills... challenge.
Yeah, I'd still give it to Seve. I mean, he never even had a 60 degree wedge, didn't even know what that was, so he could work magic with, I think his highest wedge was probably 56 maybe degrees. So
what do you think would happen if they took away wedges above 56 degrees? This just popped into my head.
Yeah, I think you'd have to understand fundamentals a little bit better. You know, the huge amount of bounce sometimes now we have on wedges that help us, you know, around the greens. You know, they tried to minimize some of it, and they with the grooves and the like, but they certainly haven't ever thought about minimizing loft. But that might be an interesting one. I mean, learning, you know, suddenly... It feels like nowadays you can pretty much get to any pin unless the greens are quite undulating. But most greens we still play on tour are, you know, modest and somewhat flat. You know, green speeds are faster, take it. But, you know, that again, the amount of people who have 60 degree and 64 degree wedges, you know, pretty much you short side yourself, you can still give yourself a good chance of getting the ball up and down. Imagine if you only had a 56. That becomes a little bit more difficult. You have to really learn how to use that wedge well to create the correct spin to get one of those short side shots close.
That'd be interesting. I always, you know, I know that'll never probably happen. I've always wanted to see, like, you know, like a 7 or a 4 or 5 club event. You know, it'd be so fascinating to see the shot making. I think that's one of the things I wish, is like seeing all the creativity and all the shots that, you know, you guys can hit would be the most fascinating aspect of it. But with the modern equipment, it doesn't seem, you don't have to hit all the shots all the time.
No, again, strategy, I believe, you know, is so much less than it was when I first came out on tour. You know, course management is, it's not really, there's not too much of it these days. Yeah, 5-club challenge tournament, that could be interesting.
Yeah.
I think people would still put the driver in.
I think you'd have to. I got to. But, so let's kind of wrap some stuff up here and a few quick hits. You know, so like, what's been the most memorable moment? Like, what's the moment you think about most going back to your career at this point?
It'd probably have to be my playoff win over Lee Westwood at Wentworth, just because it got me to number one. It was at a place just down the road from where I grew up. I had lots of family and friends there. I think it was a fun night of celebrations. That was cool. I'd knocked on the door for a couple of months leading up to that, having good chances to get to number one and couldn't quite do it. And so it was obviously meant to be to wait my time until a place like Wentworth, where, you know, very close to where I grew up.
Yeah, I saw it like Harbortown. You lost in the playoff to Snedeker. And you would have been number one then if you had got I remember. I actually remember that. You hit a wedge real close on the 18th.
Yeah, playoff hole, hit it pretty close, and Westy hit one and got a lot of spin and just crept into the water there. But I was thankful for that victory.
Who's the player that, like, best player to hang out, have like a pint with?
Tricky one, that. Yeah, lots of funny guys. Obviously made lots of good friends during Ryder Cups.
Yeah.
You know, we had a group WhatsApp chat going for the Ryder Cup, which was kind of fun. And you get to, even just through that experience, you know, different personalities. Tommy Fleetwood has a great sense of humor. I've obviously been good friends with Sergio. He's not much of a drinker, so I wouldn't choose him. I don't know. That's a good one. I don't know. Had a few good times over the years, though, but can't think of anyone specific.
Yeah. What's the best Ryder Cup memory?
Best shot I ever hit, probably, at the Ryder Cup was my 7-iron at Medina against Tiger and Stricker in the four balls. You know, just at the time, we were getting beaten pretty handily. I mean, we were down 10-4, I think, at the time. And, you know, obviously, I think what it meant in the grand scheme of things, and obviously we had the big comeback on Sunday, but winning that point and then Poulter and McIlroy winning their point to get to 10-6 to even give us a sniff, I think, and obviously against one of the greatest players of all time, he just stuffed it into 5 feet on 17. He just birdied the hole before 16. The pressure was all on us. We were only one up, having been four up at the turn. You know, it was all going away. It looked like, here goes. We're going to maybe lose this point, maybe get a half. And then suddenly I was able to come up with the goods, hit it inside him. We matched birdies and then half the last hole to win the point. So that would probably be my best shot.
What's the one where the tournament that you didn't get it done, or, you know, that sticks with you the most?
Probably that US Open with Justin. You know, I think it's funny, that was a positive time that probably turned into a negative. And I'll explain it, because, you know, obviously positive because I had a great chance to win that US Open. I walked off Sunday having watched Rose do his thing, you know, pure it the whole way around. I mean, we saw that 4-iron on the last, nearly went in the hole. I mean, every shot was just down the middle. And I walked away thinking, man, my game doesn't feel like that, especially off the tee. And I tried to change a few things. I actually went away from Pat Goss. I went to a different coach for a year, went to Chuck Cook, and, you know, obviously haven't really been as good since that time. I think, you know, obviously went back to Pat, but it took some unraveling to, you know, the swing that I tried to go to wasn't really working. I'm not taking anything from Chuck and what he does, but it wasn't right for me. And, you know, looking back, I wish I'd just stuck to what I knew I was good at. It was funny. It was a time where I had a great chance to win a major, and I walked away thinking I needed to change things. And it's just, it's a crazy the way we think.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously led to some kind of poor golf. And, I wish I'd had that back. You know, I wish I'd either played a bit better or even played really worse. I don't know. But, maybe even not having being paired with Rosie would have changed, you know, the next few years of my life. Who knows? But it's hard to have hindsight like that because...
It's, well, it was fascinating is that if you flipped the situation and you win, Rose probably would have gone, God, I got it.
Yeah, and I would have been playing like he has the last few years.
And the crazy stuff about it is, like, as a golfer, I feel like you're always envious of what someone else has, right. And they're always looking at you and are envious.
You
about
never
what
realize
you have.
That part, though, do you?
And that's the hardest thing to think about, and I never really thought about it until what you just said.
Yeah,
is that?
Yeah, you always want something that somebody else has, and when really you should be just concentrating. I think that when I got to number one, that was what my biggest skill was. I knew what I was good at, and I just concentrate on that. I didn't care that I didn't hit it as far as everyone or whatever. I knew that if I could do this as well as I needed to be, then I could be as good as I wanted to be, really, you know. And yeah, even though it was strokes gained, I think that year, 2011, I was around even strokes gained off the tee, but yeah, I knew that I needed to gain practically 2 strokes around on average to be number one in the world, and I had to do it through my strengths.
Mm-hmm. So that time you were just all, you know, focused on how do I
get better? Yeah, well, I could control.
Yeah.
Not worrying what other people were good at or mm-hmm. worrying what I was good at. Concentrate on my skill set.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's like you get wrapped up. You're always looking at what other people are doing in any industry. You know, if you're a sales guy, you know, you're looking at what the guy down the row is doing. That's, you know, maybe beat you 2 months in a row, and you're like, oh, maybe I'll try and do that. But I think with, like, sales, for example, like, what makes you unique is you. You know, and you can't try and be somebody else.
Why be anyone else? Everyone else is taken. That's what someone told me. Yeah. Just be you.
It's a good quote. So that's what I got. I really appreciate you coming on. I think
sure.
And taking the time and giving more than
well.
I
enjoyed your podcasts and everything you're doing. So good luck with it.
Yeah. When are the fans going to see you next?
I'll be out soon, either Honda or Tampa, hopefully. So making some good progress, building some great resiliency in my back, you know, just been taking it quite easy. I want to make sure I get it right, but looking forward to a busy summer, hopefully.
Yeah, Harbortown.
There we go. Let's get that win.
I know. Is it your due?
Exactly.